Blog Talk Radio.
Rising report, it's that Apple report. It's the Rising Apple report. Rising report, it's that Apple report. It's the Rising Apple report.
Indeed. Good evening, Met fans and baseball fans alike, for that matter. My name is Michael Cullen. I'm one of the staff writers at RisingApple.com, and I'd like to welcome you to episode number 133 of the Rising Apple Report. That in itself is amazing, 133. With haste, I'd like to get my co-host on the line. You know, he's a fellow writer at Rising Apple. He had me at Let's Go Mets. He completes me. He's Rich Spirago. What's up, my friend? What's going on?
Mike, thank you for the amusing introduction. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing well. And our featured guest tonight is no stranger to the show, but I'm equally delighted every time I get a chance to introduce him. He is indeed a baseball historian and fan extraordinaire. He is John Pielli. Welcome back, my friend, and before I hand the mic over to you, please, by all means, take the time you need to tell us all that you do and where we can find it, and I know you got a special project in the works, so by all means, the stage is yours, my friend. Hello.
Hey, thanks a lot, Mike. It's always a pleasure to be on the show. Rich, always good to talk to you. You can check out my work on johnpielli.com. I've done a lot of writing about baseball history. I also host a show called The Past Ball Show, where I interview current and former Major League players, but could put kind of a history twist to it to talk about, you know, the presence in the game and, you know, whether a player got one at bat or threw one pitch or is part of baseball's Hall of Fame. I think everybody that stepped on a field, you know, the less than 19,000 Major League players that I've ever played, all had an impact of some sort and make the game what it is today. I'm also working on a project. It's probably the first part of a series of projects, but through my research and with some help from others, I put together a list of the top 100 offensive position players to ever play the game. And I just throw one caveat in there because a lot of people that are listening may question this. I don't hold anything against a player, whether they are not allowed in baseball anymore, whether they're banned for life, whether they're not eligible for the Hall of Fame or in the Hall of Fame, whether they use performance-enhancing drugs, whatever it is, the numbers are the numbers. And I rank them based off of what they produced in the time that they played and their impact on the game. So once I have that completed, you know, I hope everybody will check that out. But, of course, everything that I do, you can check out on johnpielli.com. And as always, thanks, Mike, for having me on.
No problem. The pleasure is all mine. Trust me. That being said, let the party begin. And I do mean that with a double sentiment. What do I mean by that? It's the holiday weekend. There's going to be a lot of traveling, a lot of partying, a lot of barbecues, a lot of drinking. Don't drink and drive, folks. You know, have fun this weekend, but do it safely. You know, but that's not where the primary focus should be. It's Memorial Day. And that's something much more serious and something dear to my heart. I'm a veteran. I don't mean to impose this upon anybody, but this is a time where we should reflect on, you know, and we're talking for a long time now, for all the American servicemen and women, you know, who've given the supreme sacrifice for this country and helped make it what it is today, and for the men and women presently doing so, and still in harm's way. You know, because we are fighting modern wars. We're talking about, you know, our brothers and sisters, our moms and pops, and children, you know, and families. Families suffer right along with our frontline troops and support troops and all and everything of the kind. So that being said, happy Memorial Day, and thank you all for those families and for those family members who have donated everything they possibly could to make America what it is. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. And on behalf of all the crew of Rising Apple, again, thank you. I'll pass the baton to Rich now, please.
Yeah, you know, Mike, well said, because you hear a lot about Memorial Day weekend. You hear first weekend of summer. You hear beaches are open. You hear all those things. But what you don't hear enough of is what you said, and I'm not going to try to add to it because you said it very well about what it truly means. And when I think of Memorial Day, I think of a newspaper cartoon I saw probably 25 years ago. It was a picture of clearly a military cemetery. No people there, just a bunch of grave sites. And a bubble out of one grave said, "It's Memorial Day." And a bubble out of another grave said, "Yeah, let's have a barbecue." That says it all right there, because that's what it's about. It's about those people who have, like you said, given their lives, and so we can have the freedoms we have. And nobody's saying you have to be a downer and only think about that on Memorial Day, but at least spend a couple of minutes reflecting on people who have lost, people are serving now, like you said, but people who have lost their moms, their dads, their sisters, their brothers, their wives, their whatever. Think about that for a couple minutes, and think about that cartoon where people in the graves can't have those barbecues, but they gave us the right to do so. So let's just keep the bigger picture in mind.
Well done, Rich. There was a saying we had in basic training. I went to basic training in Fort Jackson. Blood makes the grass grow. And I'll leave it up to everyone to read between the lines exactly what that means. So, John, please take it from there.
Well, listen, I mean, it's hard to steal any of the thunder from what the two of you just said. If you look back at the history of baseball, and this is one of the things that I appreciate and love about the sport, is that it goes back so far. It goes back to the times of the Civil War. You know, the World War I, there were 12 major league players that ended up losing their lives in some sort of battle or illness. World War II, obviously, we've heard all the stories about, you know, Ted Williams and Bob Feller and all the, you know, the top baseball players that decided that it was their duty, number one, to serve their country, and left it all behind. Could have cared less about their playing career, could have cared less about their statistics. And I say that because I wonder, in the game that we live in today, whether that same mindset still exists. When you think of Ted Williams, you know, essentially, you know, after the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, said, "Forget about it. I'm enlisting. I'm going to be part of this. I'm fighting for my country." If you think of the top players in baseball over the last 20 years or so, I honestly can't imagine too many of them that would do the same thing. And Memorial Day obviously is a day where we remember all of those that have served our country, and all that continue to do today. And like I said, I couldn't say it any better than either the two of you, but, you know, happy Memorial Day, and hopefully everybody, you know, gets the right message and takes, you know, even if it's just a little bit of time when they otherwise wouldn't, to remember those who have fought for this country.
Well said, my friend. Well said. Again, I just like to reiterate, you know, whatever you do this weekend, do it safely, folks. No reason, you know, to delve into stupidity. You know, don't do anything that's going to get you fired from your job. You know, life continues after the weekend. So, you know, with all that being said, again, do it safely, do it smartly, and take a minute to think about, you know, why and you know, to whom we owe a debt of gratitude to make, and or who made things the way they are today. So that, you know, let's move on to the business of baseball. And John, well said, because baseball, you know, the Civil War really was the springboard for this game. You know, if you go back to 1845 and the New York Knickerbockers, and then that first game in Hoboken, you know, the Civil War really popularized it amongst a broader range of people. And, you know, what started, you know, as far as I'm concerned, predominantly in Brooklyn, you know, spread throughout the country. And yes, it was the Civil War that did that. So, you know, where there's good, where there's bad, you know, one needs the other in order to be compared. So let's move on to the business of baseball. Before I do, let's bring on an anti-guest, a frequent caller of the show. Just let me get my bearing here. And introduce everybody to a friend of the show. Just let technology work for me here. Second, Mike from Long Island. Is that you, my friend?
Yes, it is.
Hello, hello.
How are you doing
I got
tonight?
You on earlier than anticipated, didn't I?
Yeah.
You see, I'm not such a curmudgeon after all. Say hello to John Pielli and say hello to Rich Spirago.
How are you guys doing tonight?
Hey, what's up, Mike?
Hey, Mike.
So what kind of plans you got for this weekend, Mike? You know, you and your family?
Well, I got baseball tickets for Saturday and Sunday.
You know what? Excellent. And let's segue to that right away. You going to Saturday's game?
Yeah.
All right, you might have just said that. That might have went completely over my head. Let's start with the 86 Mets and the celebration that will take place at Citi Field. Why not? You know, I was going to say that for last, but why not? Let's go there. 1986. You know, Mike, obviously that happened way before your time. So what you have is a historical perspective and a slanted one at that because you're a Met fan. So what are your impressions of the 1986 Mets? Obviously, you didn't experience it. At best, you could have, you know, viewed it on video clips or read about it, anecdotal, you know, things from relatives, friends, or whatnot. So what's your perspective of the 1986 Mets?
I know they were a very complete team compared to what most major league teams were and still are. They had so many great pitchers, great offense. They were all around complete, really, of what I heard. I wasn't even thought of then. So I really can't tell you a personal experience. So, yeah, all I know is they were very complete, and I'm happy to see the whatever you want to call it, like the party for them on Saturday night.
Well, they were complete. They were about as complete a team as I've ever seen up and down the line. I'll give you my quick view of the 86 team only because I only got a full view of them for the first 3 months of the season. You know, my 86 experience extends from 1977 right through June of 1986 because that's when I lost touch. I went to another continent. I was in Germany, you know, and all I saw was Lenny Dykstra's home run against the Astros in the National League Championship Series. I saw that game, and I only saw games 1 and 2 of the World Series. And that's it. Everything else I got was through Stars and Stripes, through Armed Forces Network, at very odd hours because you had one channel, and with that one channel you had to accommodate soldiers, spouses, children, and everything. So you can imagine what kind of programming you had from, you know, half hour to hour. And Sports Illustrated and newspaper clips that were mailed to me from friends and family. So all I can gather, I mean, through just reading box scores, my eyes would just pop out of my head because here my Mets were, I mean, just so far and ahead of the pack. It was ridiculous. It's something I never experienced because up until that point, well, before 1984, 1976 was really my greatest season. It was the Mets' most prosperous season wins-wise outside of 69. You know, and I have those vague, you know, photographic memories of 73, but to wind this down, you know, the buildup between 77 and midway through 86 for me, only to not be there, well, that Lenny Dykstra home run in the NLCS stands as the Mets moment that really just made me jump up and down and just go silly. I mean, absolutely silly, because I enjoyed it from with one friend who was from Jersey City. You know, and I was surrounded by a lot of blank faces, like, what the hell are you so happy about? So after that long-winded version, John, 1986 Mets.
Well, I think one of the things that you just said kind of rings a bell to me, and it applies to the 1986 season, pretty similar to the way you viewed 1973. Because, you know, I was just a young kid. I think I followed a part of the season. But what I'll say, and I know for a fact that I remember, I could tell you that I remember 1988 a lot better than I remember 1986 firsthand. It doesn't mean I didn't watch any games, but, you know, being, you know, 6 years old, I think I turned seven, you know, in October of that year. Not a lot of memories firsthand of that team. But the one thing that stands out to me, I think of that World Series and, you know, Game 6, which is obviously being played right now on WOR, 7:10 a.m., is, and I don't think this gets talked about enough, it's the fact that the Mets were really – we're pretty much done. And, you know, as much as it gets brought up time and time again, I don't think the impact of just being down to the last out, to the last strike in front of, you know, 50,000 people, thinking everything that you did for the entire season, running away with that division, dominating, beating the Astros, looking like the better team against the Boston Red Sox, was about to crumble and just be a waste. You know, the Mets were going to go down as just another team that lost the World Series. And think about it. If they lost Game 6 of the World Series, that team doesn't get remembered in the with the amount of attention that it gets. It doesn't get broken down to all the characters. You know, you see the guys as they come, you know, as they come into, you know, to Citi Field. These players aren't remembered in the same light if they don't win that year. And what doesn't get brought up enough is the fact that they almost lost, and they almost lost very handily with two outs and two strikes in the ninth inning of Game 6. And that's the one thing that, you know, when you talk about comeback stories and just being down to really the last anything, I think of the 86 Mets in Game 6 of the World Series in the 10th inning, in that situation, to muster up those three hits, have things go their way, win that game, and then win Game 7 as one of the more incredible in-game comebacks in World Series history.
Rich, you lived it, and we have a caller waiting in the wings, and I'm sure he lived it too. I know who you are. Stay fit, hold tight. Rich, what are your impressions of the 1986 Mets?
Well, you know, it's like I've said on many occasions, with regard to that team, you have to understand context. And being very brief about context, from 1977 through 1983, it was the dark ages for the Mets. I mean, the team stunk. The attendance was terrible. It looked like nobody was trying to make the team any better. It was just a real dark age for the franchise. Okay, so fast forward to 84, when all of a sudden, here come the Mets. The Mets are in first place in late July. That's amazing, right? But then they lose. They get swept at home by the Cubs in late July. Then they go to Wrigley a week or two later, get swept again, and they're never in first place again. So the point is, 84 turns out to be, you know, you see some good signs, but you're left disappointed. Going into 85, they get Gary Carter. And Gary Carter was supposed to be the final piece. Well, what happens in 85? They lose a division on the second-to-last day of the season. Once again, you're disappointed as a Met fan. And to John's point, I thought John made an excellent point. Because the Mets came after dominating in 86, after talking a lot of bravado, the Mets came within a hair of unfulfilled expectations once again. And what ended up happening was when that World Series was over, it went from like a foregone conclusion, you know, we're going to celebrate the living crap out of this because we were the best all year and this was a foregone conclusion, we were going to win. It went to being a relief. It's like, oh, thank God we're not disappointed again. You know, and you have to remember, that's my reflection, and that's what I would like people to think about, especially people like Mike's age, is that when, you know, nothing is guaranteed. And if anything would have ever been guaranteed, it was that 86 team. They went 108-54. Let that sink in for a minute. They won two-thirds of every game, they won two-thirds of their games, right? But what ended up happening is when it came down to it, this franchise and this fan base was looking at an incredible disappointment until something miraculous happened that brought a championship. So don't ever assume anything's guaranteed. It never is. When you do have a winner, enjoy the living hell out of it because you don't know when it'll come again. We're still talking about the 86 Mets 30 years later because there's nothing in between to talk about championship-wise. So... you know, I mean, it was a great ride. It was a thrill ride all year long. It turned into a sweaty palms event at the end.
I'm waiting to go on the air.
That's and I know I got you. That's my sign to stop talking, right? So, but those are my reflections. Is it went from something that was just it was supposed to be like a triumphant ride into town, and it got really scary and. It turned into, oh, my God, we almost lost, but thank God we won. Those are my reflections.
That's great. Well, our next guest that we're going to introduce you to experienced both Met championships. He's Mr. Gary Mack. Please take your time and put in your shameless plugs, find out where we can get your work. And, Mr. Mack, so I was thrilled, you know, in retrospect, I was thrilled to have seen guys like Jerry Grody, Buddy Harrelson, Seaver, Kuzman, and then when you talk about the 73 team, Felix Mion, John Milner, even Tug McGraw for both teams. I was happy to have seen those guys play and feel, you know, a little bit of the magic of 69, even though I never experienced it. I was only 2 years old at the time. But I saw those guys who won that championship play. At least I can say that, you know. And that's the impression that John has with the 86 team. You know, and so I was thankful to have seen those guys. But you saw both championships. So your 86 mm-hmm. experience, how was it compared to 69?
Well, first off, let me say hello to everybody. It's great to be on with you guys again. I just finished my own show a few minutes ago. But I love to be on with you guys. You're the best. 86 was a completely different experience. And I'm old enough that I go back to 62. So 69 was, like, incredible to me. This was a team that was so awful, lost 120 games in their first season. They just found new ways to lose. And they were so lovable at the time, but that starts to wear off after a while. And then all of a sudden, we finished ninth in 68. We were like, hey, we're out of the cellar. But then 69 comes around. And as you were saying, I was fortunate enough to see them play in 69 and to experience that whole thing. I was in high school at the time, and it was just it's an indescribable feeling, especially the first time that your team wins a championship. And I had the good fortune, actually, to be at the game when they won the NL East division when I think it was Gentry pitched the shutout that was 5-0, I believe, and Torrey hit into the double play to end the game. I was fortunate enough to be there. I did not get to a playoff or a hockey or a World Series game. I have the hockey on TV. That's why I'm losing my mind yet. But 86 was a different experience because of the domination and because how close they came in 85. And going into 86, you had that expectation that they were going to win. And they dominated, as you guys were saying, so much that it was more expected. And it was almost more shocking that they were in as much trouble as they were during that whole playoff time.
Well, for those of you fans who are going to attend Saturday's game, enjoy the experience. For all you old-timers out there, I hope you recapture that glory at least for a couple of hours. And for you newer fans who've never experienced it, I hope your folks taught you well, you know, and go out there and applaud your Mets history. That's the best advice I can give you, man. Just go out there and give those guys a big round of applause and think about the people who aren't here as well. You know, there's Gary Carter. He won't be here, you know, bless his soul. So, you know, just take a moment to think about that as well. There's good and there's bad and everything. I just try to keep an even keel no matter what we're talking about. Memorial Day, Mr. Mack, any quick thoughts on that, Memorial Day?
Well, I just first off, I want to thank you for your service and all of the vets out there. And it is a shame that it is almost a forgotten holiday. And I know as baseball fans, we always remember the Memorial Day doubleheader. And it was usually the teams try to do something a little touching and either before the game or between the games. But just like everything else, the doubleheader and the Memorial Day doubleheader, the July 4th doubleheader, they've all seemed to disappear. But I think we do lose sight of some of these holidays as we go on. And sometimes I think it's maybe our leaders aren't doing enough to keep us reminded of that.
Well said, my friend. And for anybody who finds themselves strolling around Manhattan this weekend, if you see a Marine, if you see a sailor, if you see a soldier, you know, if you see an airman, you know, give them a shout out. Say, you know, we love you, we appreciate you, we love you, because I can't tell you how much it really does mean to them. You know, they're away from home for extended periods of time. They're away from their families and friends and loved ones and even pets. I don't mean that facetiously. And you'd be surprised when complete strangers come up to you know them and say, "Man, you know, we appreciate what you do so much. Thank you." I can't reiterate that enough. That it means something to them. It might be passe to some, but I'm telling you, it means something to them. So, you know, let's move on. Memorial Day is the first traditional checkpoint of the season, a quick National League roundup. Let's see if we think there are any surprises, you know, anybody who's down-ticking or up-ticking to our delight or dissatisfaction. In the National League East, heading into tonight's action, Washington held a half-a-game lead on the Mets. You know, if you told me on May 26th that the Mets would be a half a game out, the Washington Nationals are playing St. Louis tonight. I don't know what the score is, but nevertheless, the Mets are within, a nose of first place. In the Central, the Cubs are doing, you know, what was expected of them. They have injuries as well. You know, they're not immune from that. Pittsburgh is in second place, but they're 4.5 games out. And St. Louis is hovering around 500. I think to no one's surprise, and again, don't be surprised if they make a late, you know, season surge. That's the way of the Central. And in the West, you know, look what San Francisco's doing again. They're in first place. They got a 4.5 game lead over the Dodgers. Oh, my goodness. Strike some as a surprise. It may not strike others as a surprise, but, you know, I'll just look what the Giants are doing again. Unbelievable. Mr. Mack. I'll start with you. You know, who's up-ticking or down-ticking to your delight or displeasure?
Well, I'll tell you, Philadelphia is a big surprise. I don't know if they can last. I don't think they can, but you know what? They're doing it now, and they're playing some really good ball, and they have some good teams. Milwaukee is surprisingly better than everybody thought they were going to be. You know, I thought that this was a team that could, the way it was on paper, they could lose 100 games or more, and they still might, but at least they're off to a decent enough start. I'm a little surprised that Arizona is down where they are, 7.5 games behind. I thought that they would be a little bit better at this point. They signed Greinke. They made some nice trades, I thought. And to find themselves behind Colorado, I'm a little surprised at that in this league. The rest I'm not really too shocked about. St. Louis, you know, they're right or they're hovering, and who knows, they could put a streak together. They're not that bad of shape yet. But as the East, I kind of figured it would be the Mets and the Nationals. But I figured they'd go back and forth all season.
John, first checkpoint of the season, same thing. I'll just throw the additional log on the fire. The Mets are now 3-3 against the Nationals. Not too shabby. They lost the series here in City, and they won in Washington. Take it away, John.
Well, I'll tell you, if you look at the National League as a whole, I mean, there aren't too many surprises. You know, obviously the Phillies have gotten off to a very good start. The Phillies kind of remind me a little bit of the Mets of last year in this regard, because their young pitching is really starting to come through with Aaron Nola and Vince Velasquez. Unfortunately, this isn't a team ready to take that next step. And the one thing that if I was a Phillies fan, I'd appreciate is, you know, that their ownership and their front office is willing to put the money in if it is necessary. And if the Phillies can somehow shred water over the next couple months, play 500 baseball and just be a little bit over 500, I wouldn't be shocked if the Phillies made a trade, added themselves a big bat or something like that. But it is a lot to ask for a team that was projected to do so poorly this year. They are overachieving. Yes, their pitching has been very good. Their bullpen has been almost for lack of a better word, it's hard to describe how their bullpen has been as good as it's been, based off of the names on the back of their baseball card. I don't think that's going to hold up. That's going to be the first thing that's going to kind of blow them down the road. But if you're a Phillies fan, you got to be excited about what you've seen so far this season. They've certainly overachieved. Obviously, the Diamondbacks have been a little bit of a disappointment, but, you know, my issue with them is they put too much and put too many moving parts in at one time. And if you look back at the past several seasons, you've seen the San Diego Padres do that last year, a couple years before that, the Miami Marlins, a couple of the teams that have gone out there and made too many big moves in one off season. The one common denominator is it doesn't pan out. And I don't think there's a price you could put on team chemistry. And that's something you're never going to know until you put the players together. And I think the Diamondbacks are the latest example of a team that just hasn't gotten the right chemistry together. Yes, they made some great moves. They put in some very valuable players, but it hasn't worked in the clubhouse. It hasn't worked in regards to team chemistry. And you know what? They're looking up at 500, which is something that, based off the talent on that field that was put together by Dave Stewart, has not happened. One team that I do want to mention is the Cincinnati Reds, who seem to be in a free fall of their own. This was a team that wasn't expected to really do very much, but I think they've finally hit rock bottom. And this is a situation where I don't think the Reds are going to get any better. And, you know, the mention of a team that could lose 100-plus games, you know, there's a chance the Cincinnati Reds could push the Braves for the worst team in all of baseball. If they don't straighten out what's going on there, they have a situation where they got a couple of veterans, but they got a lot of patch players in regard, especially with pitching. They don't really give their fans really anything to root for. So I can see the Reds getting a lot better before they get, a lot worse before they get any better. But you know, outside of that, the National League is pretty much what we thought. You know, the Mets and Nationals in the East. I think the teams in the Central are going to be competitive. It's not going to be all Cubs. I think the Pirates and Cardinals are going to give a little bit of a fight before it's all said and done. And listen, the Giants did make some very good moves last offseason. They signed Cueto, they signed Samardzija. Their front three in their rotation is probably as good as anybody in the National League, which includes the Mets. And I'm not surprised that the Giants are off to the start that they are.
Rich, same stuff. The log I'll throw on your flame set us up for the Dodgers series. When we last faced them, we split four games. So your impressions of the National League so far? Mike, hang in there. I'm setting you up, man. There's a method to madness. Don't get too restless on me, bro. Hang in there. Wait patiently. You're next. I got you, bro. I got your back. Rich, take it away.
All right. So, you know, when I think about the National League at this point, I think it's almost devoid of surprise when you really come right down to it, because What were people saying? They were saying that the National League East would be a two-team race, Mets and Nats. Yes, the Phillies are in it. They're only two out, and that would be somewhat of a surprise. But I think we all feel that the Mets and Nationals will be the two teams in the National League East, you know, in a couple of months. That may not play out that way. But if you really think about the NL East, other than the better play of the Phillies, it's pretty much playing out exactly as we thought. You know, we thought the Marlins would be a 500 team, and lo and behold, they're 24-22. When you go to the Central, I think everybody thought that the Cubs would run away with it, and I wouldn't say they're running away with it with a five-game lead, but that 31-14 record is rather impressive, and again, that was expected. Pirates are hanging in there. Cardinals are maybe slightly underachieving. Actually, they just lost that game to the Nats, unfortunately. So the Cardinals are slightly underachieving at 24-23. Now, the Phillies would be my one little surprise. My second surprise would be the Dodgers and setting us up for the Dodgers series. I expected more out of the Dodgers. Right now, they're 25-23. So, you know, they're barely over 500. And the Giants, the Dodgers better watch out, or the Giants are going to pull away on them. You know, the Giants already have 30 wins. They're 30-19 with a 4.5-game lead. So yeah, the Dodgers are a little bit, if I was a Dodger fan, I'd be a little bit disappointed. Yes, they lost Greinke, but they do have some young arms. They just called up a young kid today, a 19-year-old left-hander. So they do have some good pitching out there. Obviously, they're NL West champs from a year ago. So it's a little bit surprising to see them right around 500. So overall, a couple of things that make you raise your eyebrows a little bit, like the Phillies and the Dodgers, both on the negative side. But, you know, Memorial Day is what? You know, the third of the season, roughly mathematically, a little bit less than that. And the National League, pretty much, as far as I'm concerned, looks the way I expected it to. You know, even the Mets record in specific, you know, the Mets have played 46 games, 27-19. So if somebody told me the Mets at 46 games, what do you think they'd be? I might have said 28-18, so, or something like that. Very close to what I would have expected. So, again, it's one of those things. Say you can't predict baseball. Well, maybe this year you can, right?
I hear you loud and clear. I hear you loud and clear. Mikey, you with me?
Yep, I am.
All right, listen to me, bro. After the Dodgers, and I want you to answer this question because we need the opinion of a millennial, because us old guys, most of us, we're anti-interleague play. After the Dodgers, the Mets are going to host the White Sox. I want to know your opinion of interleague play. Now, against the White Sox, you know, Matt Harvey's scheduled to make his next start. You're going to transition us into the players portion. I'm going to let you vent so you can go hog wild on Matt Harvey if you want to. And then I'm going to cut you loose, all right?
Okay.
Listen to me. We try to maintain a somewhat G-rated show. Consider your age. Then we'll get out of hand, all right?
No,
first,
no,
tell us
I'm
your
not
opinion. We're just making light. I'm just rolling chest. So your opinions on interleague, because I do think that's important, because I think the rest of the panel is a little bit more biased. Go ahead, Matt Harvey, you can have at it. So go, the stage is yours, pal.
Interleague play, I like it. It gets you out of the National League here and there. Than what they've got. Say if you come to the World Series, you've already faced them, you know what they have in the beginning of the series. From the beginning of the year, sorry. So, yeah, I like interleague play, especially Mets and Yankees. There's no problem with that, in my opinion. And now switching over to Matt Harvey. we can already just mark the loss in the book for Monday. I already did that in my book. He's actually doing better than I thought he would. I thought he would have, like, a 20 ERA by now. So he's overachieving a little bit. Matt Harvey, I just don't like. I told everyone we should have traded him, and the beat writers still don't agree with me on Twitter. I'm like, well, it looks like my trade prediction should have went last offseason. But, you know, he's costing us to lose games. And now the Mets management, why are they letting him have another start? Send him down to AAA or skip the start. Don't be babying this guy. He's a he's a man. If he can't work out a mechanical issue within 4 weeks coming from a pitcher, and I'm a pitcher, that's something wrong in my opinion. He's just a lazy bum who just does it for the money and doesn't help his team win, who tries to block out the media. I admit, Harvey.
You know, sigh out loud. You're really not off base, you know, with a lot of what you say. I get the anger, and we're going to discuss that now. So if you'll allow us, Michael, thank you. Happy Memorial Day to you, and we'll let you go. You sure you got everything off your chest, right?
Yeah, I did.
All right, buddy. So with that, you have a wonderful weekend, and, you know, you're always more than welcome to call into the show again. You know that, right?
Yep.
All right. Peace, brother.
Have a great weekend.
Gentlemen, you know, let's have at it. Matt Harvey, you know, I'm going to give – I'll open this up by saying, and I don't take credit for this quote, and I'll tell you who said it in a second. But he said – Matt Harvey doesn't, or what did he say? Matt Harvey doesn't pitch well when he has mediocre stuff. And I think it was very insightful. On Twitter, he goes by Kuzman 2.0. I think we all follow each other. What do you think of that, Rich? And Matt Harvey in general.
Well, you know, with Harvey, I think... On one hand, we're all a little surprised with how poorly he's gotten out of the gate. Now, and I think that's because he exceeded expectations last year. So probably, I know I'll speak for myself, and I would assume, you know, we baseball fans tend to think alike. So this is probably the way many people are thinking. It looked like, you know, he had, quote-unquote, beaten the Tommy John thing last year. He threw the most innings of any pitcher first year back from Tommy John, and Harvey had completely recovered, and we expected him to just, you know, go 20 and 8 this year or something like that and just continue that progression. Well, that has not happened. So I think we're all a little bit surprised by that. Now, when you pull back from that and let your logical brain take over, you realize that he is coming off of Tommy John surgery, and he is the guy who has thrown the most pitches the year after Tommy John surgery, and maybe that has an impact here. You know, maybe the arm has to recover at a pace of – maybe you have to pace that. You know, maybe the first year back gets 150, 160, and maybe he overdid it last year. Maybe that explains what's going on. So there's probably a reason for what's happening. Don't – obviously, we don't know that. But so that on the – is he a little disappointing? Yes. Is there maybe a reason for it? Yeah, maybe there is. And I think we all wanted him pitching last year down the stretch. Maybe the Mets don't get to where they got to without him. So hard to say they did something wrong, but maybe they're paying the price for it now. So maybe that, in fact, is what's happening. Now, the other side of Harvey is always going to be the personality. It's always going to be, you know, things like his general way about him. And, you know, I think we're all focused on the statement he made. You know, the statement he didn't make this week. He didn't want to talk to the media. So he needs to grow up a little bit on that one. I am not someone who believes that, you know, that these media people think that they have a God-given right to get in people's face. That annoys the living hell out of me. They do not have that right. But also, he has to be a little more adult than that. You know, he has to stand there and at least be with his teammates, you know, and not leave the stadium after a bad start. So he has to not do that anymore, and I'm glad David Wright called him out on it. Some people were saying David should have had his back. I don't agree with that. He's acting like a petulant child, and David did the right thing by calling him out on that. So that's the other side of Harvey. Then finally, what do you do with him? That's the biggest question. Now, you could talk about why is he underperforming. You could talk about is he acting like a petulant child, but what do you do with this guy? You know what my opinion on that is, Mike? Unless he's hurt, unless he needs a second Tommy John or there's something physically going on, I say keep throwing him out there. You have to. You're not going to. What are you going to achieve by sending him to the minor leagues? I don't really understand what the point of that is. And is Frank Viola's voice going to be different than Worthen's? Maybe a little bit, but to me, he's a competitor. He's a professional athlete. Let him pitch his way out of this thing. And if he continues to fail, so be it. But I just don't understand the point of sending him down to the minor leagues and letting him pitch down there. I'd say let his competitive juices take over. And unless he's physically hurt, let's work with the premise that he's a talented guy. He'll use his lack of success to his advantage. And I say go with that.
Rich, I agree with you on David Wright. Now, I just want to clarify, you know, I gave credit to Kuzman 2.0 on Twitter. What he said, he doesn't know how to pitch with mediocre stuff. Just to clarify, that's not what I said originally. And I think that's insightful. At this point, if I'm not mistaken, I do believe we have our field correspondent live from Cooperstown. Am I correct?
Cooperstown, New York. Sam Maxwell at your service. How is everybody doing? I'm currently outside Sherman's Tavern, which dates back, according to the sign, 1788. I am right off of, you know, I wish I could tell you the street I'm on, but I am off of Main Street, right off. Where am I? Pioneer Street. I am on Pioneer Street right now. And, yeah, that's basically what's currently going on in my baseball life. I saw Cooperstown Baseball Hall of Fame today and museum, of course. And what's really ironic about what we're talking about right now is that this is episode 133. Couldn't come at a better time, you guys. And I won't be able to stay on as long as I think we're going to stay on. But I do hope that before I get off of the air, we go a little bit into number 33 and also the year 1933. But that is neither here nor now currently as you're bringing me on live on location from Cooperstown, New York. To give you a little Cooperstown perspective, Bartolo is not there yet. I asked. I looked. And basically I spent my day at first taking a photo of every – Brooklyn Hall of Fame plaque in that area. Any player or any coach or any honorable inclusion being Babe Ruth, because he was like a coach for a half a season, a first base coach, was included in my photography of the day. But that was basically it in terms of all that. And I tweeted out Doc Gooden's jersey, which I came across, especially this 1986 weekend coming up. In terms of Harvey right now, I think I'll just piggyback on everything that we're talking about. Rich, you're absolutely right. Keep pitching him. I have faith in Harvey, but you're also absolutely right about the personality. I mean, I think it's clear that it's, you know what? It's not just his personality right now. It's not just his confidence. I mean, like, let's go back to when he was naked in ESPN in 2013. He is not as in shape as he was then. And I don't know why nobody's talking about this specifically. I mean, like, forget about, like, what he might have looked like airbrushed in a magazine. I don't think he's as in shape as he was in 2013, and this is not something anybody's talking about. I think it's clear. I think that
Sam, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, Sam, but I can't get the writer correct at this moment. It might have been Harper, but very recently someone, you know, questioned whether he was out of shape, just that. So it was written in either the Post or the News. I buy the News Day, the Post and the News every day. The Times, I only get on Tuesdays for the science section. Anyway, excuse me, Sam, please.
No.
But somebody did write about
I
just that.
Somebody, I hear what you're saying, that somebody might have mentioned it, but it. I mean, am I onto something? You know, I think he's out of shape. I think he's not physically as fit.
John, what say you?
I got a lot to say. I could start out by thanking Mike for what he said, because I think there is a lot of what Mike said that resonates amongst the fan base of the New York Mets. And those of whom have heard my show have heard kind of my backlash against that, which I feel that, you know, I think a lot of Mets fans don't tend to not support their own when they're going through struggles. And if you look at Matt Harvey and what he did last year, exceeding expectations through Tommy John surgery, pitching, you know, into the ninth inning of Game 5 of the World Series, going through that thing where his agent essentially called the Mets out for pitching him too many innings and essentially stepping on his agent's toes, saying, I'm going to pitch as long as I'm needed, going above and beyond like he did last season. And he struggles this season. And those same fans that were cheering for Matt Harvey to go out to pitch the ninth inning of Game 5 of the World Series can't stand him. They want to run him out of town. They hate his guts. They could come up with everything possible bad to say about this guy. But if Matt Harvey somehow gets it together and throws, you know, some of his best baseball over his next couple starts, those same fans will be talking about how much they love Matt Harvey. So, to it, I have a little bit of a problem with that. Some of it could be the millennial fans. Some of it could be the new age baseball fans. But a lot of it resonates in the city of New York, where it's, what have you done for me lately? And if you look at other regions of the country, whether it's St. Louis, whether it's, even in Atlanta, in Cincinnati, even in Kansas City, the team that just beat the Mets in the World Series, the fan bases that exist there are supportive of their teams and individual players through good and bad. And I understand that we're in a different age now, with the age of extra media, Twitter. Everybody can put their opinion out there and let it be known. They could interact with players if they want to. It's a little bit of a different age now. But I think when it comes down to it, if you're a fan of the Mets, you probably were at some point a fan of Matt Harvey. You were probably a fan of Matt Harvey when he took the mound in 2013 and started the All-Star game at Citi Field. You were a fan of Matt Harvey when he came through all the adversity coming back from Tommy John surgery last season. He's struggling this year. There's no doubt about it. All of us could put our heads together and try to come up with a reason. I don't know if we can come up with the right reason, what it is. Is he hurt? Is he just going through a dead arm phase? I don't know. But the bottom line is that, you know what, if you support the Mets and you support, you should be supporting Matt Harvey now. And to just say, hey, let's run this guy out of town, to me sounds pretty asinine, sounds pretty one-sided. Sounds like you don't care as much about the uniform that you root for or claim to root for. And I do see a problem with that. You know, in the end, I hope there's a way that Matt Harvey could get it together. And watching him, I have this fear, and I think a lot of other people that have watched Matt Harvey pitch have this same fear too. Maybe he is hiding some sort of injury. I was watching his slider in his most recent start against the Nationals, and it just looked like he wasn't finishing. Almost in a way, like he probably knew that he had to finish. He had to go a little bit further, but something was keeping him from doing that. Could that be a muscle in his lower back? Could that be, you know, God forbid, his elbow? I think that there's something that is keeping him from putting 100% of the finish and everything that's involved in pitching for him to be able to finish his pitches. So my concern, number one, is I hope this guy isn't hurt. And if he is, I hope it's not serious. But I think most Mets fans should kind of look back at what happened last year, look back at what's happened over the course of the guy's career, and realize this is a guy that you probably want to root for. And 3 weeks from now, if he's going out there throwing up zeros, the same people that are running him out of town today are going to be giving him a standing ovation on the mound of Citi Field, which to me sounds very hypocritical.
You know, John, two starts ago, there's that fine line. Did he look lethargic? Did he look like he didn't care? Did he look indifferent? Did he look hurt? Was he masking something? You know, two starts ago, I think you're onto something, because something about that performance, something about his body language screams to me, you know, like, like a pal to Bam in a Batman episode. So Mr. Mack, the Dark Knight, is this a simple matter of him going back to the Batcave and having Arthur patch him up with some bat serum and, you know, he gets back to normal? What's the deal here?
Somebody call Alfred. I mean, you know, I don't know. Sam brought up a good point about being out of shape, but is he out of shape because of an injury? Is he out of shape because of what about the blood clot, that mysterious blood clot that he had at the end of the spring training? He hasn't been the same pitcher since he had that. Is there something else serious connected to that that we don't know about? And why are they not doing? Why are they not telling us? Is it something that he can pitch through? Is it some? You know, I've heard and read every speculation from venereal disease to God knows what else, and it's all speculation. We don't know. We don't know what the doctor's reports are. If there's an injury, though, then maybe they should DL him. I think Rich brought up about he didn't understand what the minor league would do. The only thing I could say about the sending him to the minors, it may clear his head if it's a mental issue. Maybe that would give him a chance to clear his head, get away from New York. And, you know, maybe he's just a guy, I doubt this, but maybe he's a guy that can't pitch in New York. Maybe he thought he could, but now he's being challenged almost by Syndergaard, who's just a natural personality and is enjoying his time in New York. And DeGrom, another guy that's enjoying his time in New York and not getting criticized. You know, we remember he was criticized for going to a Ranger game, Harvey was. Maybe that all got on his mind, and now he sees Syndergaard doing somewhat the same thing, but he's not dating a model, and he's not out until all hours of the night, and he's not hanging around and jamming with Henrik Lundqvist and his band. I don't know if we're ever going to find out what the heck is going on, but I really think that they have to take it out of his hands, the Mets, and take control of the situation. And no matter what they choose to help this guy, because you could lose him forever. And he's got to be sitting there watching his contract go out the window that he thought he was going to get. And you got to feel for the guy, but, you know, something's got to be done with him one way or the other.
You know what? Yeah, this needs to get figured out. He needs to figure it out. But I think we're all on common ground when I say that he'll be the first to get traded. I think we all firmly believe that. It's unfortunate, but comments otherwise?
Well, his value is down now, though. So, you know, unless he can find it again, you could be looking at getting released even.
He still has time. Who knows? You know, it's such a ponderous topic. You know, where to go with Matt Harvey? I just don't know. So, you know, now that we're feeling all down and, you know, doom and gloom, let's bring up the injuries. Let's make the party worse. Why not? Travis Darnot. He's just, you know. Travis Darnot is just now getting back to, you know, what, full activity? Who knows what's going on with him? And you know what? There's a point to be made. You know, originally we weren't sure with Darnot, and then he had a setback and another setback. And then Lucas Duda. All right, a back strain. And then what? And who knows if Harvey's on the fringes, you know, of an ailment. But is this – We've been through this before. Why is this eerily similar to recent events, you know, past history, when Mets just can't come up with a correct diagnosis the first time or even the second time around? Am I imagining that, Mr. Mack? I'll go in reverse order.
I just think it's the Mets' faith that after they get into a World Series or they make the playoffs, the next year they have a bunch of injuries. I really, I don't think it's It's the they like to blame the doctors. But, you know, I mean, they're good doctors. I mean, people come from all over the world to go to the hospital for special surgery. So whether it's what's coming out of the front office and not the doctor's office could be the problem. I don't know. It's a head-scratcher, that one.
Sam, you know, hell, we can go all the way back to Ryan Church. Sam, you with me? Sam is gone. Our Cooperstown correspondent.
Hey, man, yeah, I'm with you. I'm with you.
Ah, he's here.
I think he went into Sherman's Tavern.
I did go back into Sherman's Tavern. You know what? Gary Mack nailed me. say it again. I was listening to the whole thing until you asked me a question. What was the question?
You know what? I might have been in the tavern as well because I forgot my train of thought.
So is the idea like what do we do with Matt Harvey?
Well, you know what? Let's move beyond him. I think we moved into injuries.
Let's listen. I think we keep pitching him. I mean that's the thing. Like right now, like I said, I think he's out of shape plus a bad ego, a scarred ego that literally has never been scarred from the time he was 12 years old. That's my personal opinion about the entire thing. I'm not about to give up on Matt Harvey. I don't know whether he could learn anything down in the minor leagues more than, especially in Las Vegas, more than he's learning now. I think that he needs to figure something out for these middle innings. Because that's what we're talking about. It's just like this perfect split. It's this perfect split right now. Mike, you had another question, though.
No, like I said, I forgot. But you're right. His splits, his third time through the lineup, that split is just horrific. So there's a lot to be said there, but you're right. He just needs to pitch around. He just needs to pitch. Whatever lessons are there to be learned, it's got to be done at the major league level. There's nothing for him.
Here's the thing. He became a star before he could ever struggle. I mean, he is currently still the Mets representative on the MLB Network pitch. That, like, when they're just like, hey, you should turn into MLB Network, and they try to go to every single team, and a player of representative, you know, being a representative, he's the one at the end of the commercial that goes only on MLB Network. I mean, they're saying something to where Matt Harvey got to up till this
point. Yeah, well,
and that's why we're so concerned.
That also speaks of SNY, you know, production. Anyway.
Yes.
You know, Let's just cut him short. You know,
I love these podcasts and I would love to continue on it, but I want you guys to continue without me properly, which is why I'm going to jump really quickly to number 33. And I want to just get my say into it real quick. Hold on, guys. Speakerphone. Let's take a look at the internet. Ron Hunt, Chuck Estrada, Bob Henley, Bill Connors, Les Rohr, Ray Sadecki, Matt. This is a long list. Max Scherz, Ken Sanders, Ray Sadecki again from 1 month of 77 to another. Dan Norman twice, 77 and 78. Pete Falcone, Clint Hurdle, Bill Latham, Barry Lyons, Charlie O'Brien, the infamous Anthony Young, Eddie Murray, a Hall of Famer since I'm in Cooperstown, Kelly Stinnett, Andy Toberlin, Tim Spear, Mike Kinnaid, Bubba Trammell, 2000 to 2000, Donnie Wall, Mike Bacsik, Tyler Yates, Mike DeFelice. What a backup catcher Mike DeFelice was. Tyler Yates, I'm sorry, I said him already. Jose Santiago, John Maine, my favorite guys. John Maine's my favorite New York pitcher of all time. Totally sarcastic being here, considering I saw an Andy Warhol of Tom Seaver today. shoot. Oh, it disappeared. But we know the list ends with Matt Harvey, and we're coming back around. Oh, come on. Here we go. The Dodgers sucked in 1933. The Dodgers were absolutely horrible, 65-88. And I think all you need to know about the 1933 New York Giants is that they won the World Series. Mike, back to you.
Thank you, Sam.
I think that's a good way to check out, right?
He got everything in.
back to the tavern for you.
Listen, let's be honest. Matt Harvey is still – okay, Ron Hunt, maybe. But Matt Harvey is still the number one 1933. The number one 33 on that list right now. And he needs to get it right because I think he's going to continue to do that as number 33. Ron Hunt, the first All-Star in New York Mets history, and as I said with New York Giants and Brooklyn Dodgers, the Giants won the World Series. The Dodgers were in sixth place. End of story. The next year, in 1934, we'll talk about Casey Stengel and some things he had to say about Bill Terry next week. Or whenever the podcast happens. But Mike, Rich, Gary, and John, this has been extremely pleasant. You know I always love you guys. And great off day, huh?
It sounds like it.
You know, after having heard from you, how could it not be? You know, you're like a light in show. You never know when you're going to strike and you never hit the same ground twice. It's great. Marvelous.
Thank you, Mike. Guys, all I can finish with before I hang up is let's go Mets. And Cooperstown is great. Visit it.
Let's
enjoy,
go
Sam.
Mets.
Well said, Sam.
Later, guys.
Have a good night.
Full service podcast, folks. That was our correspondent live in Cooperstown, New York. Let's get back to the injuries. Let's bring up Lucas Duda. The guy's really hurt. What are the Mets going to do at first base now? You know, would you like for them to seek a trade? Can we deal with this in-house? It's obviously too early for Dominic Smith, blah, 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 et cetera, et cetera. John, why don't you give first base a shot?
Well, listen, I think first base, we know that Lucas Duda isn't going to be around for a while. And if you look at the Mets' options right now at the major league level, it's something that they need to find some way to improve. Eric Campbell, we saw last year when he got a chance to play every day against righties and lefties, becomes a little bit exposed. I think he's grown a little bit into a pretty good bench player, a role player, a utility player. He could play a bunch of different positions, but to run him out there every day, I don't think it's giving the Mets the best chance to win. Short term, I think the Mets should try to look for a stopgap, perhaps a left-hand hitting first baseman, maybe a James Loney or something like that, just a platoon for a little while. But I do think long term, the Mets have to look to make a deal here. There are a number of options. The question is going to be, in regards to a trade, whether the Mets are willing to give up some of the better talent that they have in their farm system, which obviously you're going to have to give up if you're going to get a serviceable player like a Jonathan Lucroy or Chris Carter. The question is, do the Mets strike now or do they try to tread water for the next month or so? But I think you're looking at this offensive team, the way it's constructed, they're pretty much home run or nothing. And, you know, if it's not for the middle guys in the order hitting home runs, you're seeing a lot of stagnance, and the Mets are involved in a lot of low-scoring games, which is good because of their pitching. They can hang in them. But if you're going to look to contend with the best teams in the National League and compete for another World Series championship, I think you want to have as deep of a lineup as you possibly can. Obviously, with Travis d'Arnaud being out, with David Wright not being able to play really any more than 3-4 games in a row, needing an off day or two every week, obviously, the Mets are shorthanded every time Wright's not in the lineup, and
when he is in a lineup, he's not necessarily the David Wright of 2006, 2007. So I do think the Mets, from a depth perspective, should do something to address the first base situation in a short term. Now, this player, like I said, doesn't have to be a huge impact player, but I think somebody that could take some at-bats, can get some hits, can move the chain going in regards to the offense, and pick up for a couple of the other spots in the lineup that aren't producing. So I do think long-term, I think the Mets need to bring in another player, whether it's it's a proven everyday player, to play first base, or if they think that they could tread water enough until Lucas Duda gets back, get themselves a left-hand hitting platoon for Eric Campbell. But whatever they do, I think they do have to improve the position, particularly from the offensive perspective, because if you watch the Mets, if they're not hitting home runs, they're not scoring runs. And a lot has to do with some of the lack of talent they're running out there in regards to the bottom part of their order because of their injuries.
Yes, sir. Rich, Lucas Duda was having an inconsequential season to begin with. You're the GM. How do you proceed forward? And feel free to expand your answer to include our injury at catcher, our transient injury at shortstop, because that's important because of our lack of depth now on the bench. Wilmer Flores says he's ready to come back, but he's another one who's been inconsequential all season. And as John mentioned, we have a compromised third baseman, whichever way you shake it. So you're the GM. How do you move forward? Is Lucas due to something we have to rectify long-term and really, really think hard about moving, quality prospects? Because there are some. What say you?
Well, as I see it, so here's my frame of reference. If you look at a lineup that was out there, like the lineup that was out there Tuesday night, the 6, 7, and 8 hitters were Campbell, the catcher, and it doesn't really matter if it's Pulecki or Rivera, neither one hits much, and Ty Kelly. So, with the pitcher, you're pretty much looking at 4 automatic outs in the lineup. And if it's 2013 or 2012, where you're starting a rebuild process, maybe you just have to tough it out. We've gotten an injury or two. We're going to have to make do with what we have. But this isn't that. This is a team that is expecting to contend for a World Series championship. So you have to ask yourself, can you continue, John used the term treading water. I'm not sure that they can tread water with those kinds of players in the lineup. The David Wright thing, I'm fine when he's in there, but he's not even playing that much. So now you take a day when Wright can't play, and then you're still looking at Campbell at first base. The catchers can't hit. The offense is a little bit concerning. So can you go with it like that and expect to tread water? No, I don't think you can. And I think they do have to look to do something. So certainly the first place you want to look is within the organization. I don't see a lot of help down on the farm. Matt Reynolds is already up here, and he's not the savior anyway. Like you mentioned, Dominic Smith is probably at least a year, probably more like 2 years away. So, I think they're going to have to look outside the organization. I don't see any way around it. Now, then it comes down to this. Who do you go to? Who do you look at, and when do you do it? So let's tack the second question first. You could make the argument that, it's better to wait until July 31st and let the prices come down and all that stuff. But you know what? Between now and July 31st, there are probably 50 games to be played. You could play yourself out of this division race in 50 games. So I'm not sure that waiting is necessarily a good strategy. I don't think waiting for Duda to come back is necessarily a good strategy either. So I do think they have to look outside. Will they have to pay a significant price? They probably will. So you look at the Brewers, and you look at somebody like Chris Carter. The Brewers are pretty much out of this thing, and they're not going anywhere. So maybe you look at somebody like that. So maybe it is time to pick up the phone. This idea of, taking this passive approach until the trade deadline, I just don't think you can go with that strategy given the status of the team right now. I think you do have to look at maybe going outside the organization and, trying to do something and import a bat that way. So I would be, if I were the GM, to answer your direct question, Mike, I'd be taking a more proactive approach. I'd be making some phone calls now and kicking the tires on some players, see what it'll do to bring some help in here because, you know, like John said, Eric Campbell has shown himself to be a decent bench piece, but you can't use him every day. He should not be playing 6 out of 7 games. They just don't have the in-house talent. Their expectations are too high to play with what they have. So I don't see any other conclusion other than looking outside the organization. And about the catchers, you know, TDA, the thing about TDA is when he's in there, he can hit a little bit, but I think he's terrible defensively. So it's not like when you get him back, you're getting back the next coming of Gary Carter anyway. He can't stay on the field. Catching is probably a situation where maybe in the off season you address it. I would be more focused on first base right now. That's how I see it anyway.
Mr. Mack, you know I like to keep twisting this around and give you a different spin on the same question. Now, you know, as an outsider, one would think, you know, the Mets are 8 games over .500 and they're half a game out of first, you know, not including tonight's action with the Nationals. Everything seems okay, right? But we know injuries equal trouble. Now, here's my point. The Wilpons already had a great offseason. You know what I mean? They already had a great offseason. Now here we are in May, late May. What more can we expect them to do? So kind of sprinkle that around while you play GM for us.
Well, I think the what they're going to do is they're going to go with Flores. They're going to see if Flores can take this over and get out of this rut that he's been in early in the year. He hasn't adjusted well to the being a bench player, and they're hoping they can get him going. If he can hit and if he can play the position, I think that's they'll sit. They'll wait. I think they're concerned about getting fleeced and emptying the farm system more than they have to. I would consider talking to the Brewers because, in a way, they could kill two birds with one stone. If they could swing a deal for LaCroix, and I have no idea what it would take, but if they could swing that type of deal, he can play first. He's a catcher. He could kill two birds with one stone there, so to speak, and then you could piece in Flores or Campbell at first or whatnot. One of the other suggestions I heard, of course, that was that you could always move Neil Walker. He's played a little bit of first base. You could move him to first and bring up Dilson Herrera to play second. That might invigorate the offense, if it's a question of that. Of course, the other suggestions have been David Wright or Michael Conforto going to first base. That's not the kind of move I think you make in mid-season. That's a spring training move, an over-the-winter move. But, you know, who knows what they may try at this point. I mean, Alejandro Diaz is taking ground balls there. So maybe they'll give Keith Hernandez a call and get him down to the field and work with a couple of these guys. But I really believe it's going to be Flores for the time being. And if he can hit, I think they'll put it on the back burner until we get closer to the trade deadline or if they start falling out of the race.
All right. You know, at this point, I'm if anyone can visualize, I'm putting my hands in the air. You know, let's see what happens. But on a brighter note, the bullpen, let's give kudos to them real quick. I mean, where would we be without them? Thank goodness for them. Hansel Robles deserves particular mention. You know, even though Jim Henderson's numbers have gotten inflated of late, you know, good acquisition. Rich, Addison Reed, I know he's your guy. He's been doing outstandingly well. So anything you guys want to offer on the bullpen? John?
Well, listen, the bullpen has been fantastic. It really is, you know, outside of, you know, Syndergaard and Mats and Cespedes has been the one kind of glue that's held this team together. The fact that, you know, they got 3-4, you know, maybe even 5 guys in that bullpen that Terry Collins feels confident enough to go to, and they're getting outs.
I mean, they went, what was it, 16 or something, a scoreless innings before they gave up a run the other day. It's a good mixture. I think they've done a good job. You know, adding Bastardo, I think, helped out. Henderson has done a pretty good job. Though I think he just Terry Collins just has to watch how often he brings Jim Henderson into the game. He might be a guy that's better suited to pitch once or twice a week as opposed to three, four times a week. But, you know, Familia is back to where he was last year. I really didn't expect to see him taper off at all. And like I said, you're looking at one of the things that is underrated in regards to a championship caliber baseball team, and that is the construction of the bullpen. Because, bullpens come and go. You see how fickle they are. Pitchers from season to season that were dominant one season fall off the face of the earth the next. So if you could have a group of pitchers that are all pitching well and all kind of have that cohesion together, that puts you up there with the best teams in all of baseball, because not everybody in baseball could be able to do that. So the Mets, I would say, in regards to their entire team, that's the one part of the team that they should keep together. And I would have no issue at all if, barring injury, they kept the same group of seven relief pitchers out there and ran them out there all season, because I think the results have backed that up and will continue to back that up.
Rich, what say you?
Well, no, it's interesting how going into the season, a lot of the talk was, well, you know, if the Mets have an Achilles heel, it's the bullpen, right? But I think we on this podcast pretty much universally agreed that the bullpen should not be a problem. I remember talking about that all offseason, and we talked about the young power arms that they have, guys like Hansel Robles, and we expected a continued dominant performance from Jurison Familia. And they mixed in some other arms. The acquisition of Henderson was very well timed. So, and they have a good mix. You know, Bastardo was a great pickup. So they have a good mix of lefty-righty. Again, with some hard-throwing arms, Addison Reed, you have a former closer in the setup role. I think that's always a formula for potential success. So the bullpen doesn't surprise me at all, and I agree with John. If this bullpen can stay healthy, I don't see any reason to tweak it. You know, I really don't. They're getting the job done. I know I was talking to somebody about it yesterday when Familia kind of danced through the raindrops in the bottom of the ninth, but you know, he's 16 for 16 right now. Eventually he's going to blow a save. And when he blows one, we're all going to look at each other like, what just happened? You know what I mean? He's right? Because he's trained us to believe he's money, and he is, but he's human. And so we have a lights-out closer, if you think about that. And you also have, like I said, a former closer in the setup role, which is great. You have lefties and righties. You have flamethrowers. Yeah, I'll take my bullpen any day.
Mr. Mack, I don't know why, but Jerry Familia, he reminds me of a young Lee Smith. And maybe you can knock some sense into me, but your overall impressions of the bullpen?
I think it's been spectacular. I think they've done a great job. I liked Hansel Robles last year. I thought he had enough of a gutsy attitude. You know, he's kind of reminds you like a gunslinger comes walking in and nothing seems to bother him, and you need that. I think it's been very well constituted. They really put together a good bullpen, and as John was saying, that bullpens are flighty. They 1 year they're great, next year they're terrible. But these guys have shown that they're holding it together. That they'll have a slump somewhere during the year. But, I can really see them doing a terrific job, and they've done a great job so far. Good acquisitions. And let's not forget Logan Verrett out there as well. He's done a really nice job this year in a tough role because he's been in and out of starting, did some long relief. He's done some short relief. I mean, he's done everything, and really he's done a really fine job, and hats off to him as well. As far as Jared Familia, I don't know, a young Lee Smith, better Lee Smith than Armando Benitez, that's for sure.
I'll say.
And I know he had his problems last year in the World Series, he's still young, and that was the first time, and and it was a long season, so he might have had a little fatigue himself there. But I'll take Lee Smith over Armando Benitez any day.
I certainly meant that in a good way, by all means.
Okay.
you know what? You use the word flighty, and the person who jumped into my mind was Steven Matz. One day he's hurt, next day he's brilliant. You know, which is it? So pick it up from there, Mr. Matz. Steven Matz, how reliable can he be moving forward?
It remains to be seen, but he isn't. It just shows you what an unbelievable talent this guy is. I think it's a little bit of precaution with him that they did the whole elbow thing, and I think because of the Tommy John surgery he had, and just the rough start he got off to in his professional career, that they're probably going to be a little bit cautious. But I think. I'm hoping that he's maybe turned a corner on that he can grow beyond those minor little injuries that kept him out for periods of time last season, and maybe put together a nice run, because he has been just awesome after that first game he pitched the season where he was so horrible and got hit up. He's been unhittable. He's been fantastic. And if we can pick up the slack from Harvey with Matt and Syndergaard, you know, DeGrom's been scuffling a little bit too, but he's just such a good pitcher, and I use the words in quotes, that he's been able to get through these games and give them good efforts. And but Matt's is just unbelievable. That game yesterday was a masterpiece. That's all I have to know how to put it. He was just brilliant in that.
And John, by all means, let's expand the rest of the rotation and get the guys we haven't mentioned, Thor, and as Mr. Mack mentioned, DeGrom. No, the starting rotation has not fired on all cylinders yet. But Matt, I want to reiterate that word that Mr. Mack used, flighty. But at the same time, you know, does this guy make you think of, is this a Brett Faberhagen in the making? You know, so Steven Matz and anything you want to say about DeGrom or Thor?
Well, you know, you look at Matz, and I think the one fear that if you're a Mets fan, you've seen since Steven Matz has come up, is you're wondering when that next little injury is going to come. You know, he makes a couple starts, he misses a couple months last year. Right before the end of the season, he misses, you know, 10 days or so. This year, you know, his first start of the year is delayed a little bit. Then he goes a certain amount of time between starts. You just want to make sure that this guy is 100% or as healthy as he could possibly be. That being said, he's been nothing short of amazing this year. He had that rough start against the Marlins where it looked like the inning just kind of got away from him. But since then, he's been dominant. And he's been every bit of what you could have expected this guy, you know, coming up through the minor leagues last year and doing what he did towards the end of last year and in the postseason. If Steven Matz is healthy, I feel confident as anything running him out there and a staff that also includes Noah Syndergaard, Jacob DeGrom, and, you know, eventually Matt Harvey, you know, to at some point back up the numbers on the back of his baseball card. The Mets rotation is solid. It's been the one thing that everybody could kind of talk about as being the absolute and undisputable strength of this team. And I think because of that, the Mets are going to be able to avoid what would be that long losing streak. They may drop a couple games in a row, but there's always going to be a showstopper, whether it's a Syndergaard, whether it's a Matz, whether it's a Jacob DeGrom or a Harvey, that can go out there and pitch a big game and end, you know, what's hasn't been going well. All teams are going to go through it. The Mets are not excluded from that by any stretch of the imagination. Obviously, you know, I'm making the understatement of the day about the Mets rotation and the strength that they have within it. But, you know, you look at Syndergaard pitching the way he has. He's going to have a bad start here and there. But I think the best thing you could say is that the fact that there's so much talent in his starting rotation, that there's enough guys that could pick each other up. And when you're talking about series, when you say teams win divisions, get to the postseason every year by taking series as opposed to winning extended amount of games in a row, the Mets are in a very good position to be able to win series because of the talent they have in their starting rotation.
Starting rotation. Rich, anywhere you want to go, I'll only throw out, Fred has it, they do the wave in Asgard every time Thor pitches. The guy has been stupid. And here's a guy who didn't have a breaking pitch in the low A's, and who is the secondary player in that R.A. Dickey trade. What he's done so far is just stupid, and he's pitched, I think, to date the equivalent of a full major league season, over this season and last. And just unreal. But, just touch upon Matt real quick and then go anywhere you want to go.
Well, with Matt, I really liked what Dusty Baker said after yesterday's game when he likened Matt to John Matlack, because I've always seen that comparison myself. And to some of the younger people, you don't know who Matlack was, but Matlack came up pretty much the way Matt did. He was the guy, he was this lefty they had on the farm, and he was kind of an anticipated arrival, just like Matt was, and he didn't disappoint, and nor has Matt. When you think about what this kid has done, this kid has had, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but roughly 13, 14 big league starts. He's already pitched in a World Series, already pitched in an NLCS. He's done a lot of things in a very short period of time. He's got a ton of talent. And, New York kid, all that stuff. So I've been high on Steven Matz from day one. And obviously with the way he's been pitching since that Marlins start, I'm even more high on him now. He has a very subtle confidence about him. He seems to have the intangibles in place. In addition to his great stuff, he has a sense that he belongs. He certainly seems that way. He seems like he pitches smart, which is also very important. So, yeah, I am very, very high in Steven Matz and always have been. Noah Syndergaard has become larger than life, not only what he does on the field, but also what he does off the field. I mean, how many people can get away with what he did when he put on a Thor costume and went around Manhattan, asking hot dog vendors if they had wild boar? I mean, are you
that
kidding me?
That was brilliant.
It's unbelievable, right? This is a guy, this isn't even the off season. He did this during the season, and he gets away with it because the fans just love him. I mean, they love him the way we thought we would love Harvey. In 2013, when Harvey came up, you would have thought this would be Harvey a couple of years later, but it's not. I mean, the fans have kind of turned on him. It's really Thor. Thor's the guy. The whole thing with the hammer and whatever else. So, between Matz and Thor, that's much must-see TV. Now, to talk about the rest of the pitching staff, I've had my concerns about DeGrom for a while now, and it's only because DeGrom was a guy who relied on precision. 95 or so, low in the strike zone on the corners. That was great. But when that precision and a little bit of that velocity seems to have left, and DeGrom has been a struggle. I mean, let's face it, it has not been the same since 2014, since the middle of 2015, essentially, with Jacob DeGrom, with that one exception of the great game he threw game one against the Dodgers. But, he hasn't been the same dominant guy. And is it because, is he feeling some effect after cumulative innings, after his Tommy John? Don't know, but I can't say that I have a warm fuzzy every time DeGrom takes the mound. Harvey, we've already talked about. And then there's Bartolo. Bartolo is doing exactly what I think a lot of us thought he would. He's showing his age because he's inconsistent. He'll have a great start. He'll have a couple of bad ones. Then he'll have a good one. He might have another bad one. So at 43, I think he turned 43 yesterday or the day before. At 43, you're getting what you could reasonably expect out of the guy. The problem is, his ceiling is getting lower and lower. So in summary then, the Mets starting five was supposed to be the strength of the team. Two of the five have been outstanding. The other two of the five have been decent. DeGrom and Cologne have been essentially decent as their overall body of work, and Harvey's been a struggle. So the starting staff hasn't really lived up to expectations. And with that said, when that was supposed to be the strength of the team, and you look at the fact that they're only a full game out of first place, Memorial Day weekend, yeah, I think I think we're fortunate to be in that situation.
Well said, my friend. To that, I will only add that down, or I shouldn't say down, but out west in Las Vegas, Rafael Montero is pitching better of late, and Gabriel Ulloa is having a rather fine season for the Las Vegas 51, so perhaps there's a safety net to work with regard to the starting rotation. Otherwise, gentlemen, that is a wrap. Let's get to our final word with Ace. First, gentlemen, all, thank you. Thank you very kindly for your time this evening. Please go through your shameless plugs again. John, please educate us on what you're currently working on. Both you and Gary Mack, tell us where we can find all your work. So, Gary Mack, let's start with you. You're familiar to this routine. Your final words, sir.
Don't panic. Let's go, Mets, and hang in there. And you can find me at MetsMusing.com. It's where my podcast is. And I just thought this year I started blogging a little bit, putting my thoughts down. And that's at MetsMusingsBlog.blogspot.com. So you can find me there or at BaseballTalkRadio.com.
That's it, my friend. That's all you got on your chest.
Thank you so much for having me on as usual. I always have a great time. And again, don't panic. There's still some time, but let's be cautiously optimistic.
There's beauty in simplicity. I mean that from the bottom of my heart. John, the stage is yours. Your final word, please.
All right, well, just as always, Mike, I appreciate you having me on the show. It's always good chatting with you guys. Obviously, let's go Mets. I think, in regards to this Harvey situation, I think in the end there's going to be a positive outcome. Unfortunately, it may not be Monday. It may not be the week after. But I think assuming that the guy's not hurt, which I have a little bit of a fear that he may be nursing some sort of injury, he's going to get it together. If you watch the guy pitch in spring training, the bite that he had on his slider when he was finishing his delivery looked like he was going to be better than last year, better than 2013, and possibly one of the best pitchers in all of the game. He has to find a way to get back there. If there's something that's holding him back, he's got to get that fixed. But in the end, I think when we're talking around the All-Star break, we're going to be talking about a much different Matt Harvey. And all those who have jumped off the bandwagon and have, burned him in effigy will all of a sudden be coming back cheering for him at Citi Field like he never left, which is, like I said, I don't want to get into that again. But I think this is going to be a long season. There's going to be plenty of ups and downs. The Mets are going to pretty much be in a dogfight with the Washington Nationals like they've been from the beginning of this season. And you know what? It's going to come down to which team is going to be the most consistent. Mets battling some injuries. They're going to have to find a way to maximize every single thing that they got here, whether they're good starting pitching and their solid bullpen can make up for a lack of offense for a little while, or do the Mets have to go out there and make a move, trade for a bat, Jonathan Lucroy that could play a little first base and maybe take over and be the everyday catcher if Travis d'Arnaud isn't going to stay healthy long enough to have an impact. But, as always, you can check out what I'm doing on JohnPLA.com. I've been working on a project, the 100 greatest offensive position players of all time. And it's basically going back to the beginning of baseball, whether it's players from the 19th century, Negro Leagues players, active players, players in the golden era, the expansion era, the, post and pre-integration eras. And, once I've finished it, I'll have it published and hope you guys check it out. Be back with a couple more solid podcasts. Going to be interviewing a lot of different current and former Major League players. And, as always, thanks a lot, Mike, Gary, Sam, Rich. Talk to you guys soon.
Okay, John.
Rich? Don't fade out just yet. Rich?
Yeah, you know where to find me. I'm at Rising Apple, and so I'm same place you are, Mike. And, my final word is, I'm going to say it's a hyphenated word, one-third. And what I mean by that is we're one-third of the way through the baseball season. Now, to some it might mean, oh, Jesus, only a third, you've been playing forever, to the non-baseball fan. But to those of us who really follow the game, the season is already a third over. And let's just enjoy let's enjoy the season while it's here. Let's enjoy all the ups and downs of it. Sometimes that's easier said than done. But let's recognize that, like anything else, baseball season isn't here forever. It's really entering into its best time now, you know, going into the summer months when the sport really owns the sports landscape. And we're at a point now where we could start drawing some inferences about what the season might be, being at the one-third mark. So Memorial Day weekend, from a baseball perspective, is always sort of like the first main marker. And I think overall at the one-third point, we'd have to say we're pretty happy with our Mets. They're pretty much living up to expectations. Yes, they have some work to do, but let's take this one-third check-in point and be happy with where we are, not only as Mets fans, but also that we still have two-thirds of the baseball season left, a lot of excitement ahead, and everybody have a safe Memorial Day weekend.
Yeah, well said, well said. On that note, happy Memorial Day, folks. Like I said, do it safely, do it wisely. And just remember what the day is really about. You know, a lot of people made sacrifices, the ultimate sacrifice to this country, to give us the opportunities that we have today. And that's still going on. We still have, like I said, men, women, our children, our mothers, our fathers, our brothers and sisters, still in harm's way. And so many more have paid the price throughout our history. So keep your minds on that. I will say, like I do in all podcasts this season, this is my crusade. It's time for the Wilpons to dedicate, erect, what have you, a memorial to Mrs. Joan Payson at Citi Field. And, you know, on that note, I'd also like to throw out a proactive life preserver for them, and I'll just read a comment I made earlier that they had a tremendous offseason, you know. So we might have to temper ourselves moving forward and just see how the early summer plays out, you know. So there it is, folks. That was episode 133 of the Rising Apple Report. Gentlemen, John, Mr. Mack, Rich, thank you so very much for your time this evening. It's always a pleasure speaking to you and speaking Mets with you. So that's it. Good night, gentlemen, and thank you all for listening out there, and thank you to Long Island Mike, and thank you from our field correspondent who came to us live from Cooperstown, Sam, the converted Mets fan, Maxwell, as well. So good night, folks. Let's go Mets.
Good night, everybody. Thanks,
good night.
Mike.
Hey, take care, guys. Thank you.